Maddie is brought to you by 9.com.au. To enjoy some of our other great shows, such as NRL podcast Six Tackles with Gus, or our deep dive into the royal family, the Windsors, head to 9.com.au/podcasts or search for us wherever you listen.
In the following podcast from 9.com.au, we are not suggesting Kate and Jerry McCann were responsible for what happened to Maddie or are lying. Her case is simply a mystery, but they were considered suspects by the Portuguese police, and we examine why that was and why the questions about what happened to Maddie haven't gone away.
We're just hearing that a search is underway for a three-year-old British girl who's gone missing in the Algarve area of Portugal.
Someone's taken her. Madeline's gone.
Words cannot describe the anguish and despair that we are feeling as the parents of our beautiful daughter, Madeline.
Parents of Madeline McCann are now considered formal suspects by the Portuguese police authorities.
We have played no part in the disappearance of our lovely daughter, Madeline.
There are days when you just want to get under the duvet or just want to be in a coma till it's over, just to relieve the pain and get some peace, but you can't.
Before this week's episode, an update. Since our revelations about the DNA, many listeners have got in touch and asked why Dr. Perlin's offer was not made to Portugal's police, the Polícia Judiciária, particularly if Scotland Yard appeared uninterested. Well, I can now tell you, 2 weeks ago I alerted the director of the PJ, Luis Neves, that Dr. Mark Perlin wanted to analyse those 18 crucial DNA samples for the PJ. And last week, Dr. Perlin formally sent an offer of assistance to him. Meanwhile, Dr. Perlin's potential impact on the Madeline McCann case continues to attract international media attention.
As for the future, Perlin says he'd like to take a closer look at old crimes, but to his surprise, he's encountered resistance from some crime labs.
It's frustrating in the sense of we know the impact that DNA can have on resolving crimes, on helping the innocent, but also on protecting the public from crimes that haven't happened yet.
Fascinating stuff. And Rick, what other cases is this company working on?
Yeah, Peggy, David, it is fascinating. And they are working on a couple of high-profile cases as we speak. They've offered to analyze DNA in the 2007 disappearance of three-year-old Madeline McCann in Portugal. And they've already examined DNA in the murder case of a Georgia teacher and beauty queen, Tara Grinstead. They may be called to testify in that trial.
Last week, I also emailed Jerry McCann, alerting him to Dr. Perlin's offer and giving him Dr. Perlin's contact details. I explained how at least 16 inconclusive DNA samples in the apartment 5A living room from around the blue sofa could contain an offender or offender's DNA, and that Dr. Perlin could potentially identify that person or persons. I also explained how resolving samples from the rental car could potentially be of benefit. That same night, I also contacted the official Find Madeline campaign, repeating what I'd told Jerry McCann. One of the two email addresses on the official campaign website auto-forwarded my message straight to Operation Grange. Neither of my messages was acknowledged. Over the last few days, there have been two other developments worth commenting on. Scotland Yard confirmed they are seeking further funding for Operation Grange. Operation Grange are yet to even acknowledge Dr. Perlin's pro bono offer, which they have known about for 14 months. I've repeatedly reminded them about that offer, as have all the UK's biggest tabloids, who have followed up our revelations. We say get the DNA data to Dr. Perlin and let science breathe new life into this cold case. He can deliver the results in less than 2 weeks. 2.5 weeks ago, Gonzalo Amaral told me how Operation Grange were looking to wind up the case and were targeting a German pedophile as the man who took and possibly killed Madeline. He said a German man, currently in jail, was not responsible and that he would be a scapegoat. Just days after we published the Gonzalo Amaral interview, reports emerged from Portugal that the PJ had mobilized and were hunting a new suspect in the case. Many UK newspapers began reporting the new suspect was jailed German pedophile and known child killer, Martin Ney. That speculation about Ney, which appears to be misguided, has since been dialed right back. Before we roll this episode, for the record, since starting this project, my requests to interview the McCanns have either been declined or ignored by their spokesperson, Clarence Mitchell. On April 28, 2007, Madeline and the McCann family travelled with David and Fiona Payne and their children to Portugal. They were meeting other members of the Tapas Seven in Praia da Luz. David Payne, who was one of the Tapas Seven, recorded a video of that journey. Part of David's video shows Madeline walking on the airport tarmac as they get set to fly out from England. Maddie is wearing dark pink trousers and a light pink top. With the other small kids, she moves quickly and excitedly towards the stairs that lead up into the plane. On the third step, she trips, as you can hear here.
Oopsie, you all right?
The video then shows the McCann and Payne families on an airport bus. David Payne pans the camera. There's Kate McCann, hair pulled back in a ponytail, wearing a rucksack and a hoodie. Sean and Emily are sat next to Kate. Then there's Madeline, their big sister, her legs dangling over the edge of the oversized bus seat. David Payne stops the camera on Jerry, who stares into the lens. David cracks a joke.
Cheer up, Jerry, we're on holiday.
Tragically, 6 nights later, that holiday would turn into a nightmare. What happened to Madeline Beth McCann? How did she vanish off the face of the earth, never to be seen again? Over the last 9 episodes, we've explored what former top homicide cop Colin Sutton has described as a wholly exceptional set of circumstances. As this is the final episode of Maddie, at the end of this podcast, I'll spell out what I think happened that night. Pat Brown is an American criminal profiler from Washington, D.C., who has studied the Maddie McCann cold case extensively. She's written several books on serial killers, the art of criminal profiling, and the cracking of cold cases. She's also written a book about the Madeline mystery. In one of my conversations with Pat, I asked her if she thought Maddie was alive or dead. Pat's answer was direct. She laid out a line of thinking that left little to no room for grey fuzz. For Pat, it was brutally black and white.
There is zero evidence that she is alive. And the McCanns would like to say there's zero evidence she's dead, but there's a heck of a lot more evidence leaning that direction than there is that she is alive. Literally, the only way she could be alive is if we ignore, first of all, a good portion of evidence from the day of the crime, the evening of the crime, and from the crime scene and from the investigation. And we then assume, because we have no evidence, we assume she was kidnapped by somebody who wanted to keep a little child as one of their family members, or somehow take her into the sex trade and keep using her for a decade without any harm coming to her. Those two scenarios, extremely unlikely. Almost unbelievably unlikely, and I can tell you why right up front. Let's say she was truly kidnapped. The most likely kind of person who would kidnap a child that young, 3 years old, would be a sexual predator, a child sexual predator. And almost every child of that age who is kidnapped by a child sexual predator is dead within an hour or two. And there's a good reason for that, mostly that three-year-olds are difficult. I mean, parents go crazy having a three-year-old around their house. I mean, our own three-year-olds drive us nuts because they complain, they whine, they cry a lot. And can you imagine a child who's lost their parents and is now in the care of a stranger? Most child sexual predators have no desire to take care of a child. So what they want to do is use them in the way that they want, and then they eliminate them as quickly as possible so they don't have to deal with them. They've had their fun, and I put quotes around that, but that is what it is to them. They've had their fun, and now they just want to get rid of the evidence. So if Madeline were actually kidnapped, almost like I would say a 99% chance that she was kidnapped by a sex predator and was dead right away. If somebody wants a little child, the last thing you really want to do is kidnap a child out of a prominent family who's on vacation, because a whole police force is going to come down on you. It's going to become a big, huge, it's going to be all over the media, which it was. And the same thing is true for someone who would want to kidnap a child into sex trade. Again, well, you know, you can get a drug addict's child, a prostitute's child, a child who's living in extreme poverty in a good portion of the world. You can sometimes buy children. You don't need to go in and start an international incident. If you, that's just not a good way to get away with crime. So anybody looking at this situation would say, nobody's going to take that kind of risk. The only person would be a child sexual predator who happened to note that the child was there and think they could get in and out really quick and get, then get rid of her when they're finished. So it just makes no sense, these ideas that she's in the sex trade someplace or living in a family. So we're either looking at a child sex predator who got her, or we're looking at the fact she died in the apartment for some reason.
My name is Mark Salnokonoko, and I'm a reporter for 9.com.au, and this is a podcast called Maddie. The Maddie podcast series explores what many believe is the well-known story of Madeleine McCann's disappearance. But this is an investigation of the evidence that could make you question everything you thought you knew about the case. Near the end of July 2007, 3 months after Maddie vanished, Jerry McCann took a trip to Washington, D.C., leaving Kate alone with the twins in Praia Del Luge. Jerry was in the U.S. Capitol to visit the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. He was also there to conduct a series of interviews with American broadcasters, raising awareness of Maddie's disappearance. The day after Jerry left, on July 23, Kate McCann picked up the phone, punched in some numbers, and made a late-night phone call to a Portuguese police inspector. His name was Ricardo Paiva. Paiva spoke good English. After Maddie vanished, Portuguese police assigned Paiva to work as the McCann's liaison officer. His role was to ensure the flow of information between the McCann family and the police. What Kate McCann and Ricardo Paiva spoke about in that late-night phone call has since been hotly disputed. Paiva said when he picked up the phone, Kate was upset and tearful. Giving evidence during the McCann versus Amaral libel trial, Paiva said Kate told him she had dreamt Maddie was on a hill and that police should go search for her there. He said the impression that he and other police got was that Kate was insinuating Madeleine was dead. He called it a turning point. Paiva said that phone call led to Portuguese police inviting UK search expert Mark Harrison and the cadaver dogs to Praia Del Luge, which we covered in detail in episode 4. After Paiva had testified under oath, describing his recall of that conversation with Kate, Jerry spoke to reporters outside the court. He refuted Piver's recollection of the call and what Kate had supposedly said. Jerry said Kate had never had a dream that Madeleine was buried somewhere.
It is particularly disappointing that certain police officers within Portimão, who considered us as possibly involved in Madeleine's disappearance, have not been able to change their mind despite a lack of evidence. And it is these officers who we are dependent on for pursuing the investigation within Portugal. And I'd like to make it absolutely clear that Kate has never had a dream that Madeleine was buried somewhere. And I don't know if something's been lost in interpretation, but that didn't happen.
To the east of Praia Del Luge, a large area of desolate scrubland sits atop cliffs which rise up from the beach. At the easternmost point of the beach sits a large and imposing volcanic rock known as Roca Negra, meaning black rock. Paiva said, following Kate's phone call, where she mentioned Maddie on a hill, police searched this area around the Roca Negra. Searches were conducted, but police found nothing. Meanwhile, someone somewhere knows what happened to Maddie and has hidden it for 12 years. How can that happen?
On average, people lie about once a day. And what you see is that with practice, we actually become better at lying. And if you look at people that lie a lot and lie often, they are a lot better at concealing it. So yes, with repetition and with practice, we become better at concealing the truth.
That's Dr. Celine Van Gold, a forensic psychology lecturer at the University of Sydney. Dr. Van Gold is the head of the university's Innocence Project, which is known as the Sydney Exoneration Project. Madeleine McCann has been missing for over a decade. That's a real long time for someone who knows something to be holding on to a terrible, soul-destroying secret, an awful lie. I asked Dr. Van Gold, if someone told a lie often enough, or lived a lie long enough, could it actually become their new truth?
In my opinion, I know that there's different opinions about it, but I believe that people can actually become convinced of their lies. They might believe that their involvement was less than they originally thought, or that certain chain of events went slightly different, which then would exclude them from being guilty. So it's more likely, or a bigger percentage of people will believe that they're lesser involved in specific things and change certain parts of their memory than believe that they're completely innocent. But it is not impossible for people to become completely convinced that they're innocent and believe their lies. People sometimes lie about a crime to protect someone else.
Most global innocence and exoneration projects focus on DNA evidence. But Dr. Van Gold's setup at the University of Sydney is a bit different. Instead of focusing on DNA, the Sydney Exoneration Project looks at false confessions, mistaken identifications, and false memories. Two days after the McCanns were declared arguidos, the Portuguese police released a 16-page report, which alleged the kidnapping of Madeleine may have been simulated. It was written by a detective called Tavares de Almeida. In it, he questioned the May 3 timeline the Tapas 7 and the McCanns had told to police. He wondered about the reliability of the Jane Tanner sighting. He wondered about the visit David Payne made to the McCann apartment at 6:30 p.m. on the night Maddie vanished, the visit where Kate said David stayed 30 seconds and Jerry said David stayed 30 minutes. The alerts for the cadaver and blood dogs was also highlighted. There appeared to be doubt over how Madeleine disappeared.
There's no evidence anybody entered that apartment from the outside, a stranger. There is absolutely zero evidence of this. And that's very important, because when you say, what about kidnapping, where is the evidence that that child was kidnapped? There isn't any.
In this final episode, criminal profiler Pat Brown will test possible theories about what might have happened to Maddie. What Pat is claiming there is correct. There appeared to be no forensic evidence of a break-in on the night of May 3. And we've covered that extensively in earlier episodes.
One of the theories, and I tend to lean toward that one, is that they may have medicated their children. And in doing that, their belief was, we'll give them some medication, they'll go to sleep, and therefore the reason we're not worrying about them getting out of bed and getting into trouble is because they're not awake. So we can go away and come back and check on them, make sure that they haven't woken up for any reason, give them enough medication to make them sleep.
During the summer of 2007, in the months after Maddie went missing, media began to speculate about the possibility Maddie and the twins, Sean and Emily, could have been sedated. The Portuguese police appeared to seriously explore the sedation of the children as a potential theory. A common question in this case is why? Why, if something accidental happened to Madeleine in apartment 5A, why would Kate and Jerry not just call an ambulance like you'd expect? Well, if Madeleine had been sedated or something else had occurred, that would be revealed in an autopsy. That would result in potentially dramatic repercussions. On the morning of September 7, 2007, Kate McCann was called into the Port Amau police station. She drove the 25-minute journey from Praia da Luz to Port Amau. Three detectives were waiting. They were about to declare Kate McCann an arguida, a formal suspect. What happened inside that police interview room was later revealed after the case was shelved and a massive tranche of police files containing thousands and thousands of pages was released to the public. The files appeared to show police were interested in and investigating a scenario that Kate could have been implicated in Madeleine's accidental death. Some context for what follows. Kate was a trained anaesthetist, a doctor who sends people to sleep for operations. During the police interview, detectives asked Kate McCann 48 questions. Some questions were innocuous, such as, "On May 3, 2007, around 10 p.m, when you entered the apartment, what did you see?" Others were more accusatory, such as, "Did you have any responsibility or involvement in the disappearance of your daughter, Madeline?" Kate McCann point-blank refused to answer all 48 questions. Some of those 48 questions appeared to zero in on the possibility that Kate may have sedated Maddie and the twins. "What is your medical specialty? In England, did you medicate your children? What type of medication? Is it true or not that the twins have difficulty falling asleep, that they're restless and that this upsets you? Why did the twins not wake up during that search or when they were taken upstairs?" Following the instruction of her lawyer, Kate exercised her right to silence, knowing her answers could be used against her later. It's entirely possible at this point, Kate felt police had stopped looking for Maddie and that they were instead building a case against her and Jerry. If your lawyer's telling you to stop, you probably would. But on the other hand, why wouldn't a mother answer any question that may help police find her missing child? No matter how difficult those questions might be, and regardless of any consequences. In a 2008 interview on BBC Breakfast, Clarence Mitchell, the McCann's official spokesperson, tackled that kind of question head on.
Right, one thing that has emerged, which has been picked up by one or two of the papers, was the questioning of Kate McCann by detectives. It's on the record that there were 48 questions during her questioning, which she refused to answer. Why so many?
Why so many questions? Well, you have to ask the police.
Why did she refuse to answer?
Because her lawyer advised her not to answer. She had been made a guida, and that gives you rights under Portuguese law not to answer incriminating evidence, and nor should any inference be taken from that refusal to answer. Her lawyer had advised her not to answer for fear, basically, that the questions were going to be leading and take her into areas that were possibly incriminating.
But, I mean, some of them seem sort of fairly straightforward as to how she raised the alarm, what she first saw, what the state of the room was, all that sort of thing. Surely would have help them develop the inquiry.
Her lawyer advised her not to answer the questions, and in that situation, Bill, if you had your lawyer telling you not to do something, I'm sure you probably wouldn't do it.
At the end of this long, intense encounter in the Portimao police station, detectives put one final question to Kate. Kate was asked, "Are you aware that in not answering the questions, you are jeopardizing the investigation which seeks to discover what happened to your daughter?" Kate replied, "Yes, if that's what the investigation thinks." At the time, a couple of British tabloids reported allegations Kate McCann could have given the children Calpol to help them sleep at night. Calpol is a kind of paracetamol medicine for infants. Here, being interviewed on Portuguese TV, Jerry McCann vigorously denies suggestions that they ever sedated Madeline or the twins.
"In that evening, did you give to your kids something like Calpol to help them sleep?"
"You know, we're not going to comment on anything, but, you know, there is absolutely no way we used any sedative drugs or anything like that."
The suspicion of Portuguese police about sedation seemed to stem from a statement given to them by a GNR officer called José Roque. Officer Roque was one of the first law enforcement officials to arrive at apartment 5A after police were called on the night Maddie was reported missing. Remember, the GNR are the National Guard of Portugal. They're not official police. At the scene of the crime, Officer Roque observed that twins Sean and Amelie never woke up, despite the commotion caused by the crowd of the people moving in and out of 5A. Sean and Amelie remained motionless and sleeping the entire time. In his translated statement, Roque described Kate and Jerry as being nervous and anxious. He claimed he did not see any tears from either of them. He said they produced noises identical to crying. It's hard to know what to make of all of this. Who knows how you might react if you were in Kate and Jerry's shoes? It could trigger outright hysteria, or it maybe freezes you up and shuts you down, sending you into a state of catatonic shock. In a 2007 BBC Panorama investigation, Jerry is filmed driving in the family's rental car 3 months after Maddie vanished. He's talking about the night of May 3. He's talking about the twins being sound asleep and the aftermath of Maddie going missing. He alludes to themes of possible sedation and drugging by an abductor.
There had been quite a few people in the apartment, but not into the bedroom. That was limited to myself, Kate, I think two of our friends, the two GNR officers, and I think the translator. I was certainly saying to people to stay out of the room. There was no sealing off of the room, and the twins were still sleeping in their cots. So we tried to leave it as undisturbed as possible. And they slept very soundly until we moved them out of the cots into the other apartment. Which does make me wonder about whether there was any substances used to keep them asleep.
In October, 5 months after Maddie vanished, strands of hair were taken from Sean and Emily. A toxicologist tested those hair samples for traces of sedatives and drugs. The tests came back clear. Gonzalo Amaral later claimed the toxicology tests were carried out too late. He said if toxins were present, they would already be long gone. However, I've spoken with a toxicology specialist in Sydney, and he told me traces of drugs in someone's hair can be found months and sometimes even years later. Inside apartment 5A, where the McCanns were staying, there was a blue two-seat sofa in the living room. On the night Maddie vanished, that sofa was positioned up against one of the living room walls. It sat beneath a sliding window, which looked out onto the street below. Pat Brown speculates how the blue sofa could have played a part in Madeline's death on the night of May 3.
Perhaps she was woozy. We don't actually know what happened there, but the most prominent theory is that something happened where she fell. She got up on the couch, leaning toward the window, and somehow went over the back of the couch. And whether she hit her head in some strange way or whether she asphyxiated by the position she ended up in is unknown. But that's where the cadaver and blood dogs hit, was behind the sofa. And there's really no good reason for those dogs to hit behind the sofa unless, A, they're completely wrong, or B, a body was there. And if there is a body behind the sofa, it's because somebody ended up there. And that would be Madeline. And some people will say, oh, well, maybe the kidnapper panicked and did something to her and then hit her behind the sofa. Or maybe somebody else hit her behind the sofa. Nobody hides bodies behind the sofa in those situations. So it makes much more sense that an accident occurred and the child simply ended up behind the sofa.
However unlikely, it is still possible someone in a total panic might choose to hide a body behind a sofa. During my conversation with Pat, she explained how regular people could be expected to react when a crime which ends in an unexpected death suddenly occurs.
Here's what happens with people is that when something happens that it's a panic situation, you're usually not really brilliant at that moment, especially if you have very little time. All you're thinking about doing is anything that's a desperate attempt at changing the scenario. So if you find your child dead in the house and you feel like, oh my God, we're going to go to jail, we're going to lose our careers, we're going to take our children away, I've got to do something here. I got to make it look like it wasn't us. I can't have them finding the body of my child in the apartment. If you're in a panic, you may well just pick that child up and carry that child off.
We're not saying that's what happened, but it helps to understand why the Portuguese police did not initially rule out the McCanns as suspects. So let's take a moment to quickly recap. The last time anyone outside of the McCann family in the Tapas 7 reported seeing Maddie alive was about 5:30 p.m. on May 3. That sighting was by Katrina Baker, Maddie's nanny at the kids' club. At about 6:30 p.m, Jerry was at the tennis courts. He asked David Payne to go up to apartment 5A and check on Kate and the kids. Kate, Maddie, Sean and Emily were going to join everyone at a communal area for a brief playtime before bed, but that plan changed and that get-together never happened. Kate said the kids, especially Madeline, were too tired. There appeared to be discrepancies over how long David Payne stayed at 5A during his 6:30 p.m. visit. Kate said David stayed about 30 seconds, but Jerry told police David did not return to the tennis courts until closer to 7 p.m., a visit of around 30 minutes. On that evening, Kate said she read Madeline her favourite book, Mog. They also sang Happy and You Know It. At 7:15 p.m., Kate and Jerry said they put Maddie, Sean and Emily to bed. They read a final story before Kisses and Lights Out at 7:30 p.m. Kate and Jerry then showered, changed and went to the tapas bar at 8:30 p.m. Jerry said he checked the kids at 9:05 p.m. He said his check only took a few minutes. But if you cast your mind back to earlier episodes, you'll remember how we've flagged up a couple of times how Jane Tanner remembered Kate moaning that Jerry had been gone a long time because he was watching the football. Around 45 minutes later, according to police statements, Kate McCann discovers Madeline was gone. Her account of the window being open and the shutters up came under scrutiny and were questioned by the Portuguese police.
And I just ran back into her bedroom, and literally at that point, the curtains, which were closed, just kind of flew open. And that was when I noticed that the window was open as far as it could go and the shutters outside had been raised all the way up. And I just knew straight away that someone had taken her.
In episode 2, former Nottinghamshire Police Superintendent Peter McLeod described the bedroom window and shutters. He said the window was small, no bigger than 50 centimetres wide. I'd asked him if he thought it was possible to climb through it with a small child.
I frankly do not think it's possible. It would be difficult enough to get yourself in. You'd have to grab hold of windows and grab hold of things. But of course the shutters are the problem, because the shutters are going to be bashing down on your head.
Right.
Either that or you've got to put a piece of wood in or something. And there's no suggestion of any of that. And then you've got to pick up a child without waking it up, without waking the other two children. I do not think it can be done, or let me put it another way, I do not see how anyone could do it.
Criminal profiler Pat Brown is certain Smith Man, the man the Smith family from Ireland spotted on the streets of Praia da Luz at 10 p.m, is critical to the case. Scotland Yard later declared the Smith sighting vitally significant. The man the Smith saw was carrying a motionless barefoot girl in pyjamas. She looked like Madeline. The Smith sighting occurred about 300 metres south of the Ocean Club Resort, just a few minutes' brisk walk towards the beach from apartment 5A. The Smiths bumped into the mystery man about 100 metres away from a rocky coastline.
One of the reasons you don't know what happened is because a person simply got lucky and got away with certain aspects of the crime. They were able to get rid of certain evidence. They weren't seen. So sometimes what happens is you just can't answer all the questions. One of the biggest pieces of evidence we have is the Smith sighting. We absolutely know one thing. That sighting exists. The Tanner sighting, questionable. The Smith sighting, that is a solid piece of evidence. There was a sighting of a man carrying a small child toward the beach. Now, who is that man? Well, no man has ever claimed to be that man. So what we have is an unknown person taking a small child toward that area. That's a fact. That's evidence. Now, the question is, did that person turn from that area, you know, somehow, you know, go a different direction and then go to his home and hide the child there, or take the child to a car and drive off? Possible. That is possible. The only other possibility is that the child's body had to be hidden somewhere along that beach area. When I got to Praia da Luz, that's exactly where I looked. Where could her body be put? Temporarily? Really temporarily? Or, you know, could she be hidden here for a few hours and then come back? And I looked at what would be possible for someone to do who had a very short amount of time.
Pat Brown said when she visited that shoreline and scoped out the area, there were upturned boats that could be pretty good temporary hiding places. The coastline close to the road where the Smith sighting occurred is mostly shelves of rock which gradually drop off into the ocean. The shelves of rock have deep creases, folds and crevices. One thing to think about the search that happened on May 3, just after Maddie vanished. As police, townfolk, Ocean Club employees, Jerry McCann and some other men from the Tapas 7 searched late into the night, their mindset was that they were looking for a lost, missing girl. They weren't searching in the types of places a small, dead girl could have been hidden. Say, inside a rubbish bin, in the open crease of a rocky shelf, or underneath a fishing boat. Pat Brown thinks it's possible, deep in the night, under cover of darkness, that Maddie's body was moved and hidden.
Well, she moved actually twice that night, where she was placed someplace and then come back later when people are out searching. I find that a good possibility that, indeed, that the body of the child might have been removed from the apartment and then moved again. And the reason somebody might do that is because at a certain point, they are afraid that where the body is going to be discovered. Because where you put the body originally is in a panic situation. You do what you can, the quickest thing you can. And then later on, you have time to think and think, oh, I should get that body out of there and put it someplace where nobody's ever going to find it.
Pat Brown actually thinks it's possible Madeline was moved 3 times, with the third and final move coming several weeks after May 3, to dispose of the body in a place where no one would ever find. But let's get to that later. In the meantime, Pat believes she found a spot, let's call it Location 2, that could have acted as an excellent intermediary hiding place for a body. In Pat's theory, Location 2 lies at the eastern edge of the sandy beach, as the cliffs begin to rise up from the coast. Go to 9.com.au/Maddie to see a map of all these key locations. In August 2007, when UK search expert Mark Harrison was called to Praia da Luz by Portuguese police, he too pinpointed this area as a potential location where someone could have hidden Maddie's dead body. There are no houses close by, just cliffs, creases, rubble, and brushland. It's close to the Rocca Negra. Remember Kate McCann's dream at the start of this episode? Anyway, I'll let Pat carry on.
I did find a place right on the beach, which is an area where the McCanns have spent time. And what they have these crevices that come down to the beach, which you could just walk up. And they're filled with sand and little rocks and things. Very easy place to place, put a body and just cover that body up with the sand and the rocks and secure it there. And as a matter of fact, that same location, you can drive a car right near it, park the car right at the edge of where the rocks are, and you can just run right up and remove a body and put it in a vehicle and take it away. Now, do I know that's exactly what happened? No, I do not. There's no evidence.
Police found no evidence at all that Maddie could have been buried there, temporarily or otherwise. In late August 2007, search expert Mark Harrison sent police teams and Eddie, the cadaver dog, to search around that vast area and up above the cliffs, but they found nothing. Does finding no evidence prove that Pat's theory is wrong? I put it to Pat that without evidence, some people may struggle with this unproven theory.
People could say, well, that seems kind of difficult. And the answer is true. But then we talk about a thing called luck. Sometimes you just get away with things. You get lucky and nobody discovers the body.
You'd have heard Pat speak about a road that runs close to the area, which we have called Location 2. Above the cliffs, there are also a couple of one-lane dirt roads and rudimentary tracks which head towards the beach in that area. During my chat with Pat, our conversation veered off to the rather grim subject of how people typically choose a spot to dump or dispose of a body. That conversation would send me on an unusual journey, but more on that later. According to Pat, here's what runs through the mind of someone who has the rather large and unwanted problem of a dead body on their hands.
The person usually takes the body to a dump site that they're very comfortable with, because when the person's doing the killing, they might have no witnesses and they might get away with that. But now they've got this body in their hands, and they go, okay, where do I go with it? You want to go someplace where you pretty much know I could get away with this. I can dump a body here, and nobody's going to see me, and nobody's going to suspect me. That's the thing people do. They do the thing that solves the problem as quickly as it can be solved, and in a way that they're the most comfortable and will be the least noticed as well.
Pat's theory then takes one final step. Some might consider it a leap. Some might even claim it's a leap too far. But first, let's recap. Pat believes the man the Smith family saw at 10 p.m. on May 3, carrying the limp girl, is the likely perpetrator. She thinks it likely that man was on his way to put Maddie's body in a temporary hiding place, location 1, on the night of May 3. Later that same night, while a frantic search for Maddie is underway, he moves her to location 2. There, he buries her in a shallow grave of rocks, rubble, and sand. Then, weeks later, that man secretly returns to the shallow grave. Under cover of darkness, he uses a car to get close to location 2, which is a zone Mark Harrison had flagged up as a place where someone could have likely tried to hide a body. Once there, the man removes the body and puts it inside his vehicle. He then drives off to put Maddie's body in one final hiding place, which to this day has never been discovered. Some might find Pat's theory pretty jolting. I know I did. What I realized was that if this theory was to be considered, I was going to have to find out if it's possible to move a dead body from a grave weeks after it is buried. That question took me to the door of Dr. Maiken Euland, a forensic scientist at a very unique place known as the New South Wales Body Farm.
I'm a special branch. I'm in forensic taphonomy. So I look more at finding remains, how we can locate them, and also figuring out how long they've been dead.
The New South Wales Body Farm is the only one of its kind in the world outside of the US, where there are 6 such facilities. Body farms allow scientists and law enforcement agencies to precisely study the decomposition of bodies under different conditions. Prior to meeting Dr. Euland, I'd sent her an email. In it, I asked her detailed specifics about the decomposition of a body buried in location 2. I gave Dr. Euland a range of average temperatures for prior deluge in May, June, and July. I also described a shallow grave of rocks, sand, and stones. It was an unsettling email to type up, but Dr. Euland needed specifics to give an accurate answer.
So I'm guessing for your scenario, in the first couple months, it should be relatively easy, obviously, to uncover and then to remove the remains. When you get towards 3, 4, 5 months, you're likely to face a bit more of this disarticulation, and it's going to be a lot more challenging.
So there it was, a gruesome job, but possible, definitely possible, for someone to bury a body, return up to 8 weeks later, and move it somewhere else. When I was speaking with Gonzalo Amaral, linked up on that 3-way conference call with him and a translator, I asked him if anything had happened between 2007 and now which had impacted or altered his theory about what could have happened to Madeleine McCann. Gonzalo's book, The Truth of the Lie, theorized Madeleine could have died in the apartment by accident, an abduction had been simulated, and her body removed. During our conversation, Gonzalo gave some insight into what could have happened to Madeleine's body and where it might have been hidden for several weeks. As far as his original theory went, Gonzalo was sticking with it.
Well, nothing has changed in his opinion about, in his perspective about the case, because his perspective is based on the first 4 or 5 months of the investigation. The whole team, the conclusions of the team are summarized in the report that Inspector Tavares Almeida made. It reflects the conclusions of the team, of their work in the first few months. And Gonçalo says that those conclusions have yet to be disputed or denied. And that his opinion remains the same as he explained in his book, which reflects the case files. And that nobody to this day, despite all the efforts of journalists, marketing managers, image consultants, nobody has managed to disprove the conclusions that the PJ, that Gonzalo's team reached at the end of September of 2007.
The report of Tavares de Almeida, which Gonzalo just mentioned, was filed on September the 10th, 2007, 3 days after Kate and Jerry McCann were declared arguidos. Arguido status was, of course, lifted from the McCanns in 2008 when the case was shelved. In the report, a number of issues were highlighted, which appeared to bother the PJ. The report questioned the veracity of the group's checking system. The report noted there appeared to be no forensic evidence of a break-in, and it discussed cadaver dog alerts and possible sedation of the children. Jane Tanner's account of witnessing a potential abductor also came under pressure in the report, as did her account of walking right past Jerry and Jez Wilkins on the night that Maddie vanished, without either man seeing her. Jane and Jerry had disagreed over where he and Jez Wilkins had stood when Jane reportedly walked by them. Remember this, the scene from the C4 documentary, Madeline Was Here.
See, I think you were about here. And I think you were standing like that, and Joe and Jez was there with his pram pointing down that way. Because I think if you'd have been looking at me, because I would have said something, because I would have said about, because Kate had been moaning that you'd been gone a long time watching the football.
I'm almost certain that when I came out, I came over and he was here, and I was like that. That's my memory of it.
4 days after Maddie vanished, Jez Wilkins sat with police to make a statement. He sketched a map for detectives, which you can see on 9.com.au/Maddie. On his map, showing the lane right outside 5A, he marked an X. The X was right where Jane Tanner had indicated. During our conversation, I asked Gonzalo where someone could have hidden Madeline's body, perhaps in a temporary hiding spot. He explained a line of inquiry his team of detectives were investigating before he was removed from the case. That line of inquiry involved a mystery apartment and a freezer.
What happened here was that the investigation was interrupted, and at the time that it was interrupted, the team was looking for an apartment that had been mentioned to them. The problem was that the investigation was interrupted, and the team was not able to follow up this lead completely. It's not impossible, it has happened before, that bodies have been frozen and then transported in cars. It's a possibility that they were investigating, that a frozen body would have been transported in the car.
It's a remarkable claim that a body could have been hidden in a freezer somewhere in or around the town of Praia da Luz. To that end, Gonzalo replied, as far-fetched as it might seem, it was a possible hypothesis nonetheless. He repeated several times how people can and do put dead bodies in deep freezers. I went away and checked that, and he's right, it can and does happen. One such case was Amanda Oakes, a 36-year-old mother from Alabama, USA.
Amanda Oakes, who was accused of leaving her dead infant in the freezer of a Dothan hotel room. Donna Williams live in the studio tonight with more on this story.
Investigators found the body of Amanda Oakes' 6-month-old infant. According to investigators, Oakes told them the baby's body was placed in the freezer when the smell became unbearable. Police believe the body had been in the freezer for at least 5 to 6 days.
There's a philosophical principle called Occam's razor. Basically, it states that if there are several explanations for an occurrence, the one that requires the least speculation is usually better. It's a pretty good rule of thumb. The more assumptions you have to make, the more unlikely an explanation. While we're philosophizing, here's one thing worth considering. In the McCann case, there really is no Occam's razor. All actions and theories appear unlikely, and, as former homicide detective Colin Sutton said, fantastical. Colin has cracked 30-plus murders and was responsible for bringing serial killer Levi Belfield and Britain's worst rapist, Delroy Grant, known as the Night Stalker, to justice. Remember right back in episode 1, Colin Sutton was pondering the theories, from a stranger abduction through to potential involvement from someone known to the family.
Whichever of those kind of choices you look at, you've got to say that each of them has a degree of incredible facts mixed in with it. And you've got to kind of think to yourself that whichever of those it comes down to be in the end, and whatever the truth is actually a bit fantastic in this case. It's a wholly exceptional set of circumstances.
If we think about someone accessing a fridge or freezer, then it's perhaps necessary to open up the idea that perhaps something happened earlier than the night of May 3. As we know from an earlier episode, an unusual sequence of events did begin to unfold after quiz night on May 1, but it's a radical departure from what the McCanns and the Tapas 7 said happened on the night of May 3, that an abductor struck and stole Madeline. In any homicide investigation, you have what you know and what you can prove. They're two quite different things. One thing that deeply frustrated Portuguese police was the refusal of the Tapas 7 to return to Praia da Luz for a crime scene reconstruction in 2008. At this point, Maddie had been missing for 1 year. The police wanted everyone, including Kate and Jerry, back at the Ocean Club Resort, there in real time. They could make everyone retrace their steps. Remember how many people were moving around on the night of May 3, checking up on Maddie and other children? Police believed a reconstruction could help show if everything fitted neatly together, or if maybe it fell apart. The police files showed a series of emails sent back and forth between the Tapas 7 and the police. The Tapas 7 expressed concern about the press frenzy if they flew back. They were worried about the McCanns' Arguido status. They wanted to know if actors could be used instead. Negotiations stalled, and the reconstruction never happened. Reading those emails, I wondered where the concern for Madeline was in all of this. The official fund set up by Kate and Jerry is called Leaving No Stone Unturned. It's a strong message, full of intent and purpose. But in some instances, it appears some stones have been left unturned. I believe DNA expert Dr. Mark Perlin is a man who can breathe new life into the 12-year search for Madeline. As we know, he's confident his powerful DNA technology can successfully solve 18 inconclusive DNA samples. Those samples could identify an offender or offenders and confirm or rule out if Madeline's DNA was present in the boot compartment of the McCann's rental car. But Scotland Yard and DCI Nicola Wall, who heads up Operation Grange, have refused to even acknowledge Dr. Perlin's offer. The UK Home Office, who has funded Operation Grange with $20 million over 7 years, has refused to comment or acknowledge Dr. Perlin's offer. The UK Prime Minister Theresa May, who launched Operation Grange in 2011, has declined to comment on an offer to solve DNA samples for no cost and in less than a fortnight. Dr. Perlin's offer is now with the PJ and its director Luis Neves. But Gonzalo Amaral fears the PJ will simply ignore and refuse Dr. Perlin's offer, just like Scotland Yard appear to have done.
Yeah.
Gonzalo says there is absolutely no political will to solve anything. He tried to be heard in a parliamentary inquest, but nobody was interested. And there seems to be absolutely no will to solve this case at all. The only intention, apparently, is that it is mentioned as little as possible and that nobody talks about it too much.
In my conversation with Gonzalo, he detailed a potential line of inquiry he believed was important. It involved the possibility of an international pedophile ring that may have links to people close to or in contact with the McCann family. Gonzalo told me about some statements which could have potentially assisted that line of inquiry. He claimed those statements had been buried by British police.
The British authorities tried to conceal the statement, and nothing was done about these statements. They were not followed up. Nobody investigated anything related to them.
Gonzalo continued, explaining that while he was leading the investigation back in 2007, his team of detectives had asked British police for further information about a potential person of interest.
The British police said that there was absolutely nothing. Of course, at the time when the British police stated that they did not have any information, they already had the statements. So there is this issue with the British police concealing information that they already had. When the statements finally arrived, they came mixed up with other papers. They came within a stack of other documentation about the case. It is apparent that someone within the British police decided to break the silence and sent these documents to the Portuguese police.
Gonzalo told me he wondered how motivated UK police might have been to follow up this line of inquiry, or if the waters had been intentionally muddied. The statements arrived at the PJ 1 month after Gonzalo was removed from the case, which was 1 month after Kate and Jerry had been declared arguidos. I asked Gonzalo what would have changed if he and his team had been given the information they were requesting.
It would have changed everything. He would, of course, have investigated these statements, and he would have done a specific questioning about this.
These are pretty big claims Gonzalo is making. So I put these allegations to the Leicestershire police because they were the UK police force who worked alongside the Portuguese in 2007 and 2008. But they declined to comment. They referred me to Scotland Yard. When I contacted Scotland Yard, they refused to comment. A response from that organisation, which I have become very familiar with. It's worth noting the Leicestershire Police Force are currently the subject of a government investigation into allegations that former senior officers may have inappropriately modified evidence. Their actions may have hampered multiple investigations of a now-dead British lord accused of being a paedophile. The Leicestershire Police received child sex complaints about Lord Greville Janner in 1991, 2000 and 2006. While not linked to what Gonzalo Amaral is claiming, it does show there have been separate allegations of a corruptive element involving a number of senior officers in the Leicestershire Police, hampering an investigation into a suspected paedophile. 2 months after Madeleine vanished, a former British politician named Sir Clement Freud invited Kate, Jerry, Sean and Emily for lunch at his holiday villa in Praia da Luz. After that visit, which Kate detailed in her memoir, Freud, a grandson of acclaimed psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud, befriended the McCanns and stayed in contact with the couple. Just before they were declared arguidos, Kate and Jerry made a second visit to Freud's villa. According to Kate's book, they stayed several hours drinking brandy together. Kate claimed Freud had made a joke about the dogs Eddie and Keeler. "So what are they going to do?" Freud remarked. "Put them on the stand, one bark for yes, two for no?" Freud died in 2009, aged 84. 7 years after his death, allegations emerged that he molested three girls and could have abused dozens more. While serving in the House of Commons, Freud shared an office with another MP, Cyril Smith. When Smith died in 2010, numerous allegations of child sexual abuse against him emerged. There are ongoing investigations into whether police and prosecutors may have covered up Smith's abuse of young boys. In 2016, one of Sir Clement Freud's accusers told newspaper The Independent she felt uneasy after reading about her abuser befriending the McCanns. She contacted UK police, but said they were dismissive of her information. Freud was not in Praia da Luz at the time Maddie vanished, and I'm not suggesting he was involved in her disappearance. Coincidentally, in 2008, Clarence Mitchell, the McCanns' longtime spokesperson, signed a 12-month contract with Freud Communications, a company owned and run by Sir Clement Freud's son, Matthew. In that time, Clarence continued to represent Kate and Jerry McCann. Again, while I simply don't know what the truth is, Gonzalo Amaral has always alleged there was interference from the UK in his investigation. He's long claimed that he was removed from the case because of political pressure coming from somewhere. He was removed in October 2007, and the case was shelved in April 2008.
When he was dismissed from the investigation, the team that came in to replace him was only dedicated to archiving, to shelving the case, and they had only to go through the motions to achieve the archiving of the process.
Despite the evidence and vast amount of ground we've traversed in Maddie, what you also need to know is that there's still more evidence and parts of the story that I couldn't tell you about. There are some elements to this mystery that contain too much of a legal risk to include, such as the incredibly delicate nature of reporting this case. We'll keep pursuing the DNA data and following up the line of inquiry that Gonzalo Amaral talked about, the international pedophile ring. In making Maddie, there were people and sources with potentially important information who couldn't quite take the step to speak with me on the record. That could change over time. Information was also passed on to me, and we're sifting through that to see where and who it could lead to. So what do I think happened to Madeline Beth McCann? I don't think Madeline McCann was abducted that night. I think something else happened to her. I think Madeline McCann died in apartment 5A. I think her body was disposed of. But by who? There is evidence that points to possible answers. Clearly, Operation Grange must go back to the very beginning and explore all possibilities. Anything less is a travesty. An innocent girl is still missing. Thank you so much to all of you for listening and supporting the Maddie Project. Thank you for the messages and all the information which has been sent to me. Dan McHugh, Simon King, and I would like to thank the following people for their invaluable contributions to the Maddie Project. Tara Blancardo for graphics, maps, branding, and artwork. Kaya Officer for legal counsel. Lucy Lowe, Tom Campagnoni, Damien Axiak, and Megan Wilson for video. Mark Dodd for support and graphics. Joe Abbey for media, Karishma Sakari for research, 9.com.au digital director Helen McCabe, and digital editorial director Kerry Elstub for backing this project. To all those who were interviewed and bravely went on the record to share their insights into the case, in order of appearance, Colin Sutton, Dr. Mark Perlin, Graham Wetton, Peter McLeod, Paolo Reyes, Jim Gamble, Mark McLeish, Pat Brown, Sonia Poulton, Duarte Levy, Mick Swindells, Andy Redman, Paul James, Enid O'Dowd, Alessandra Viena, Joseph Mora, Ben Fordham, David Rudolph, Manuel S. Fonseca, Gonzalo Amaral, Martin Grime, and our translator, who wishes to remain anonymous. There is a group of people whose research was a tremendous help to make the podcast, and we would like to thank Lizzie Taylor, Ben Salmon, Cherry, Helen, Carrie, Linda, and Isabel McFadden. And to those who wish to remain anonymous, you know who you are. Thank you. This podcast is dedicated to Madeline Beth McCann, born on 12th of May 2003. Though it seems you are unable to make it home, may truth be found and those who hurt you be brought to justice. The Maddie Podcast is reported, written, and narrated by me, Mark Salnokonoko. Dan McHugh is our producer and sound designer. Simon King is our editorial advisor and editor. You can read more about this case and the podcast and see interactive graphics and maps on 9.com.au.